It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, one of the world's most popular board games is celebrating a major milestone today. We'll find out how it's managed to survive and thrive for eight decades.
First, President Obama is calling on the federal government to reduce its carbon emissions by 40% over the next decade in an executive order signed today. This is building on a previous order that planned to cut emissions by 28% by 2020.
The federal government is the single largest energy user in the United States, with 360,000 buildings, 650,000 vehicles, but even so, it only produces about 0.6% of all U.S. emissions. So does a slice that small make a difference? Here with us now is Kate Shepard, senior reporter and environment and energy editor at the Huffington Post. Kate, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what did the White House say? What was the reason they gave for giving this order?
Two things, I think, are their main points. One is that they already laid out this 28% goal a few years ago. They've gone pretty far in meeting that goal, so they want to get more ambitious going forward. That's one reason. The other reason, I think, overall that they're setting these goals is that they want the federal government to be a leader. If we're going to be saying that the private sector needs to be reducing emissions, well, the federal government should be starting by taking that on themselves.
Now, is this binding in any way? What happens if the federal government doesn't reach its self-imposed goal here? Do they find themselves?
They probably get a nasty grin from the White House if they don't meet their goals. It's more of an ambition. I don't think there's a penalty if you don't meet it, but I think it does set a goal for these agencies. And since the government is huge and there's lots of different agencies and they all have different budgets and different agendas and different areas in which they work, it tries to sort of bring them all together around a common goal.
Based on what we've seen already in emission cuts, is this goal doable?
Well, they've already hit 17% reduction from 2008 levels since they put these goals in place in 2010. So that's a pretty big chunk. This is more ambitious. 40% is obviously much higher, but it's another 10 years to get there. I think they think they can make it. The question is, how much if they've already made efficiency gains and started rolling out solar, how much more can you do going forward? They seem to think that it's possible to do more.
Now, cutting 40% of 6%, of 0.6%, I'm sorry, that's what, 0.24% of the United States' emissions? It's not a lot. It's not a big deal. Is this just sort of a happy gram to environmentalists in the United States?
It's not a lot if you're thinking about overall all of the U.S. emissions, but the U.S. government is a huge consumer of energy. It's the single largest consumer of energy, and the biggest part of that is Department of Defense, and that's not just here in the U.S., but they have installations all around the world. So it has a sort of broader impact, and the federal government buys things from suppliers. It has an influence on the communities around all of these installations. So it does have a wider impact than just that 0.6%, because they're pushing others to make changes as well.
Right, and I've seen arguments that, okay, maybe this is a small percentage, but if the federal government starts buying a lot more solar panels, that's going to boost the manufacturing economy, maybe ultimately bring the unit cost down for private users of these products.
Right, exactly. The U.S. government purchases things in a private market. We work with contractors from all different kinds of industries. So you are basically pushing them to make better products and to make investments in improving their emissions as well.
Now, a lot of the administration's goals have been nationwide private industry, power plants, that sort of thing. Where is that part of the agenda right now for the Obama administration?
Working on the clean power plan, which would be these targets to reduce emissions from new power plants and also from existing power plants across the country. They have issued the draft rules for both of those. They're supposed to be finishing those rules sometime this year. The question is, they're supposed to have them done this summer originally, and the timeline's been pushed back a little bit. So we should be seeing final versions of those rules sometime soon, but then you'll have to also see the implementation period. So under the way the clean power plan is crafted, each state would come up with their own plan to meet the emissions targets that have been set out for them. So that would take a little bit while longer to see what the state plans look like and then have them approved at the federal level and then see them start going forward.
Politically, this fits into a pattern where the White House knows or the president knows this particular thing won't pass Congress. But what can we do? How far can we get with the powers of executive action? What do we have control over? Do you see it fitting into a pattern here?
Absolutely. And the senior advisor at the White House, Brian Deese, today said in the call with reporters that they want this to demonstrate that they're going to stay on offense. I think that was a message to Congress that, look, like, you can oppose our agenda any way you want in Congress, but we're going to do what we can within all the other powers that we have.
Now, have we seen any kind of response from either Congress or from, say, the oil or coal industry on these changes?
I haven't seen anything, too vocal so far. I'm sure there will be a response, but these changes are already underway. They've already made pretty significant cuts to the federal agencies. There's not a whole lot they can do to stop it.
Now, the big energy story a lot of people are waiting on is the Keystone XL pipeline. Congress had passed a bill. The president vetoed it, but the pipeline's still under review, I think, by the State Department. Does this detract or distract attention from that, or do you think that's the ball that a lot of people have their eyes on?
Oh, I mean, everybody's waiting for the Keystone announcement. In a lot of ways, this probably today's announcement might have more effect on overall emissions on a day-to-day basis. But we're all waiting for it. We don't know when states are going to issue their decision. The administration's been hesitant to put out a timeline for when they're going to say yes or no to this permit. So we're all sort of in a holding pattern. And especially in Washington, I think the Keystone XL has become more about talking about Keystone XL than it is about actually building it. So that's probably going to be the one that gets the most talked about here in town.
So with this announcement, this executive order to reduce emissions, what's the timeline? When do you think we'll start seeing changes? What kind of changes will happen first?
Well, I think all of these changes are already underway. They started these in 2010, really, so I don't think that there'll be a huge noticeable change. But they said that they're going to make a lot of these investments in energy efficiency and all of these buildings that the federal government owns, so you might see energy efficiency upgrades at federal buildings. They're also talking about improving the efficiency of the federal fleet. The federal government owns thousands of vehicles. Switching those to hybrids, switching them to other kinds of low fuel use vehicles, you'll see that changing. So maybe you'll see some kind of hybrid National Park Service vehicle rather than a conventional one sometime soon. Those are the kinds of things that those are changes that you'll probably notice if you're paying attention.
Now, going to the bigger picture, the Obama administration has said the United States is going to work to reduce its overall greenhouse gas emissions about 25%, a little more than 25% below 2005 levels in the next 15 years or so. Now, that's not just the government. That's the whole shebang here. Is that at all likely?
The U.S. has put that goal out there. Countries around the world are putting forward their own emissions targets in hopes of working towards some kind of international agreement by the end of this year. The countries are putting out their goalposts here in the early part of this year. The question is, what is going to be the legal format for that decision? So will the U.S. be held to those emissions targets, or will we just be sort of allowed to put them out there and meet them as they come? And will other countries as well? Like, what would the system be for making sure countries meet those goals that they put out? And that's still not clear, and hopefully it's something that is resolved by the end of this year.
Before we wrap up, this is an executive action we're talking about now from the White House. Therefore, the next executive, whoever that might be, could keep it, increase it, or get rid of the whole thing. Is there a sense that this all might change if there's a Republican president next time around?
I mean, absolutely. Executive orders are, quite easily changed when the next executive comes in. I think that the administration's argument, they also say that this is cost-saving and that you're saving American consumers around $18 billion because they're not spending all that money on energy. So even if the next administration is not as gung-ho on addressing climate change, maybe they'll see it as a good way to save money and as a good, dollars and cents kind of decision. So that would be a good reason to keep this kind of goals in place. I mean, it's, we'll see who's in office next time around and how they feel about that goal.
Kate, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Kate Shepard, senior reporter and environment and energy reporter at the Huffington Post, talking about President Obama's executive action to cut federal government carbon emissions by 40% over the next decade.
Coming up, we'll take a look at the board game Monopoly Secret to Success as it celebrates 80 years on the market. First, one of the most popular board games in the world is celebrating a major milestone today. Love it or hate it, Monopoly, the game of property transactions and plastic houses, officially turns 80 years old today. That's 8 decades worth of go passes and collections of $200, which really adds up after a while, it turns out.
According to the game's current publisher, Hasbro, more than 275 million copies of the game have been sold worldwide. Monopoly is available in 111 countries, 43 languages. Throughout the decades, it's gone from a simple board game to a full-blown cultural phenomenon. But as other games have come and gone, how has Monopoly survived and thrived, especially in an increasingly digital world?
Joining us now to talk about the game's lasting influence is Phil Urbanes. He's a board game designer, author, and president of Winning Moves Games. In addition, he's written a handful of books about Monopoly and has served as chief judge at the U.S. and World Monopoly Championships. Phil, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica and Rob. Great to be with you.
So when a person, say, turns 80 years old, we tend to ask them, what's the secret of your longevity? Well, let's do that with Monopoly. What has Monopoly done to keep on going for so long?
Well, I believe in very simple terms, Monopoly is as young as the people who play it currently. So, for example, if you, I, and you know, Rob were sitting around a Monopoly table or Monopoly game, the experience that we'd have around the table would be fresh and new because of who we are and how we interact. The game is just a vehicle for that.
Do you think that's true of games in general? It's not so much the game, it's the players?
Not all games, but really great games are long-lived because they bring out delightful parts of our human nature that might otherwise never surface because we tend to be very careful of how we interact with each other. But over a game board, you know, the hair is let down, the top button is unbuttoned, and we just show who we are, and we have a great time escaping real life by playing a game.
Well, it's also been pretty handy turning out editions of new Monopoly games. There's still Monopoly, but there's now Frozen Monopoly, The Walking Dead Monopoly, also, I guess, a Game of Thrones Monopoly coming. Does that sort of popular franchise tie-in help?
Well, isn't that amazing that a game like Monopoly can be extended time and time again, married to a theme that's currently popular, and yet the basic core game doesn't lose any appeal? It just seems to get, you know, more popular. I think the reason is because everybody knows how to play Monopoly, and when you tie it into a theme that you really love, whether it's Frozen today or maybe even a game based on the city of Milwaukee or perhaps it's an old TV show like I Love Lucy, somehow those two interests meld perfectly together, and if you're a fan, you want to have that game for no other reason than simply to collect it and show it proudly in your home.
As we mentioned, we're in an age of digital gaming. There's a big board game boom, too. How has Monopoly bridged that gap and embraced or worked along with technology?
Yeah, I think since the 1980s, Monopoly has been available in increasing alternate media. For example, at first it was just video game cartridges, then home computers, but now you can play Monopoly with your handheld device, and it's possible to play it virtually with people from any country on earth, which is one of the wonderful things about the digital age that we live in.
You know, the thing about Monopoly is it can be a long game. Sometimes you start a game and it just drags on into the wee hours of the night and everyone wants to quit. I've been in games like that. I've been in quick turnaround games. But do you think Monopoly is still well suited to the times, given that this is a game you really have to invest in and focus on?
Well, I have good news there, because for the last few years, a new component has been included in Monopoly called the speed die. And if you use the speed die in play, you can have all of the fun and authentic experience of Monopoly in less than an hour. And that's because with the speed die, properties get into circulation quicker and the big rents get paid more often at the end. So that's been a major reason why Monopoly now is probably more appealing than ever.
Well, can I throw a pet peeve of mine at you, Phil?
Yeah.
The money on the free parking. It's not in the rules, right? It's a house rule. It makes the game longer. I say if you play Monopoly, no free parking money. What's your take?
House rules in general are designed to make the game go on a long time because people don't want it to end. But if you play by the rules, a game of Monopoly, and I've judged so many championships, I can tell you for a fact that even the best players finish a game in 90 minutes, despite all the negotiation that goes on.
Well, to spin off that, for me, the big question over the years, and I've given this some deep thought, is do I buy the high-rent properties or do I buy the less expensive properties and really get going quickly with houses? Which strategy usually wins?
Well, Veronica, the secret of success in Monopoly is to try to get the oranges or the reds. And the reason is because players go to jail consistently during the game, and they must go through the oranges and the red when they come out. And that means those properties get landed on more often, and because they're relatively inexpensive, you can afford, if you get either of those groups, to quickly build them up. And one other secret is, if you look at any property deed in Monopoly, you'll notice a huge increase in rent between two houses on a property and three. So if you can get to the three-house level on a good color group, the chances are you're going to win the game.
Nice. Well, I never knew that. So the oranges and the reds are the middle-grade properties. They're neither the cheap ones or the super expensive ones.
Right, but they're sufficiently valuable when you have three houses or more on them to drain the cash from your opponents that would otherwise be used to buy those expensive properties and build expensive houses on them.
Let's keep this between the three of us so we can beat everybody. Well, now, as a game designer yourself, what do you see as the influence of Monopoly on board game design since Monopoly?
Well, it's been said very often that if Monopoly was to appear for the first time today, it probably wouldn't succeed because, you know, it's a game that has a bit of a learning curve and it has a lot of concepts that you have to digest. But because it came out during the Great Depression, when people had a lot of time and they could only hope to be rich, they wanted to learn the game, they wanted to play it, and then it became a cultural fixture, and generation after generation was taught the game by, you know, parents, grandparents, aunts, and uncles. I clearly remember playing it for the first time with my aunts and uncles and what a thrill it was. So Monopoly is probably not a great indication of what you can do today, but it certainly is an indication of having the right item at the right time. Games today, if they come out and they're new, they have to be something that most people can figure out within 60 seconds, so that's very demanding.
Now, Monopoly, as you said, it's become its own force. It's a cultural icon. The president referenced Monopoly money in a State of the Union speech. What do you think accounts for that?
Because we all know it. Monopoly is, as a judge of world tournaments, one of the things that gives me such pleasure is seeing people from around the world who don't speak our language or we don't speak theirs, but you put them around a Monopoly board and suddenly they smile and they know what to do because Monopoly is a universal language unto itself. So it's so well established, it's so well known, and Monopoly money has so many, it conjures up so many images when you use it in conversation. So why not use it in a presidential speech?
As someone who judges tournaments, Monopoly is a game. It's got dice. It's got random card draws. So how much is there luck and how much is it skill to win this game?
Well, a good friend of mine once told me he thought Monopoly was 75% skill and 75% luck, which is a humorous way of saying that it's very much like real life. You know, if you got a break or two in real life and you have the skills to exploit the breaks, you're going to go far. But if you're a really skillful person who, for whatever reason, just gets a bunch of bad breaks, it takes a long time to overcome them. Monopoly teaches that. So you can be a complete expert and know all of the right things to do in the game, but if you don't get the right circumstances to come your way, it's like real life. You have to work harder.
Now, when you talk about some great games of chess, these are things that people say can be games of great beauty and elegance. Is the same thing true of Monopoly? Have you, as a judge, seen some really elegant, beautiful Monopoly games?
Well, I've seen some breathtaking decisions on the part of players that caught everybody by surprise, but then turned out to be the game winner. So that the elegance in Monopoly mainly comes through appreciating the simplicity of the board, you know, and the charm of the playing pieces and the cuteness of the houses and hotels. But the real elegance comes through the human interaction, the deal-making that takes place between the players.
As someone who judges Monopoly or a game designer yourself, are you good at Monopoly? Do you tend to win when you play with your peers?
Oh, I get that question a lot. Well, first of all, most people don't want to play me because they have this erroneous assumption that because I know the game so well, I'm bound to win. But for the reasons that I just mentioned, if you can't get other players to deal with you and work with you on trades that will advance your fortunes, it doesn't matter how skilled you are. So I would say that I win my fair share, but I lose as much probably as I win.
Do you think Monopoly today is well-positioned to be an evergreen game, a classic that people are going to play not just for the next several years, the next decade, but well beyond that?
Well, I think as long as there is a need for human beings to connect with each other and to talk verbally and to read facial expressions and to savor the idea of getting rich vicariously, then Monopoly is well positioned to have a long, long run. If we as human beings should shy away from what I just pointed out as our Monopoly strong points, then the game will fade.
Phil, a question we can't let go before we're done here. What's your favorite playing piece?
That's a great one. You know, I have done a lot of research into the psychology of each playing piece, and believe it or not, there is actually a personality profile that typically is associated with each piece. Now, I tend to like the race car, and the reason for that, or the thimble, and I'll tell you the reason. The race car is the only token on the board that actually moves in real life on streets. I think that's pretty cool. Now, I tend to like the thimble if I'm playing really great players because there's a rule of Monopoly that says if a player doesn't realize you owe him or her a rent, you don't have to pay it if enough time goes by, which is two more player turns. So if you have a little innocuous token that doesn't draw most attention, a lot of attention, very often you can, or I shouldn't say very often, but every now and then you can get away from paying a big rent.
Wow, I never knew that. Phil, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Veronica.
That was Phil Urbanes. He is a board game designer, author, and president of Winning Moves Games. He joined us to talk about Monopoly's 80th birthday.
Coming up after the news, Governor Walker's mantra has been that Wisconsin is open for business. Well, is it? We want to hear from you. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Beginning yesterday, Wisconsin's Joint Finance Committee is traveling around the state listening to what the public thinks about Governor Walker's budget proposal.
Since taking office, one of the governor's most recognizable slogans has been that Wisconsin is open for business. So how is that slogan borne out in his budget and in what he's done so far as governor?
In order to answer that question, we'd like to hear from you. If you're a business executive in Wisconsin, we especially want to hear your thoughts. Or have you sought out workforce training or maybe a job over the past 4 years? How do you think the governor's policies have affected you? And how do you think his current budget could affect you? You can reach us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Mary Eisbester joins us now. She's the president of GenMet, a metal fabricator in Mequon, Wisconsin. She's also the chair of the Governor's Council on Workforce Investment and was the co-chair of the U.S. Manufacturing Council, reporting to the U.S. Secretary of Commerce. Mary, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
So you work in manufacturing. What kind of policies do you feel are key to the success of manufacturing here in the state?
Well, the things that affect businesses generally are very similar. So manufacturing is not an exception. Lower taxes that allow our businesses to be more competitive, whether we're competing with other states or other countries, is very important. Ensuring that we have an infrastructure within the state to support good business. And then certainly probably one of the most important things, and this is very, very relevant to manufacturing, it's the workforce. You know, our people really, at the end of the day, are what make us good businesses, and a highly skilled workforce is going to make our manufacturing businesses the most globally competitive.
Now, there's a balancing act in any government. How much can you lower taxes while still trying to pay for the infrastructure you mentioned, education to provide that workforce? Where do you see the way, or how do you see Wisconsin doing when it comes to balancing out those two sides?
You make an excellent point, and it's interesting that I believe Governor Walker has begun to operate the state and creating a budget for the state very much the way a business would. And creating a budget for a business is a difficult task. Creating a budget for a state is nearly an impossible task. And it's very much that balancing act that you referred to. Some of the key principles when you think about how you run an effective business is how do you not starve the things that give you a competitive advantage while still being fiscally responsible and not being overly leveraged with a lot of debt. And I think what the governor is trying to do is spur economic growth and development by lowering taxes, and he's been a particular friend to the manufacturing sector with regard to the zero manufacturing taxes that our businesses now this year get to take advantage of, and having to find efficiencies and ways to look for waste and cut those things and try to very much it's a balancing act, as you said, and I'm of the personal opinion that taxes are not necessarily a bad thing. They are absolutely necessary to support education, infrastructure, all of the things that government should be responsible for. It's just a matter of ensuring that they're spent responsibly and in a way that allows our businesses in the state to be competitive, because that's really, at the end of the day, how people stay employed and how the state can continue to be healthy overall.
Well, I want to get into some of the details of how Governor Walker's policies have affected the way you do business there. And you mentioned that manufacturing tax, that the change that kicked in this year. Can you just lay out for us, how does that actually work at your business? What does that allow you to do?
Sure. So when we are providing pricing to our customers, and again, this is probably not unique to manufacturing, there's pressure that's put on all businesses from competition, and again, whether it's local or international, to do a couple of things. One, certainly not to raise prices, if at all, to lower prices, and oftentimes to reduce lead times. So it's very challenging to do those things if taxes continue to increase or other fixed expenses continue to increase, right? So finding ways to return value to your customer at the same or lower prices, one of the key things that we can do is when we know that taxes will be less, we can actually reduce our quotes or keep them the same over time, and it gives us a competitive advantage over other states that maybe aren't doing that or have different tax policies or are increasing business taxes. Internationally, the United States has the highest tax rate of any developed country, and so it really does make it challenging to be competitive internationally if we have really high tax rates. So that has really been advantageous for our ability to control prices long term.
Does it allow you to invest more in your business, say new manufacturing equipment or hiring more workers, having those kind of tax changes?
Without a doubt. Being a small business, we are organized as an S corp, and a lot of small businesses are, what they call pass-through entities, where we actually are taxed as individuals rather than as large corporations, and we don't have access to a lot of the tax mitigators that large corporations do. So having a reduction in our overall tax on manufacturing activities absolutely leaves more money in the business for investment, both in technology, new equipment, new processes, and for allowing us to hire more people. Some of that advantage is being offset a little bit by increase in insurance costs and affordable care insurance costs. But anytime that we have an opportunity to save money, I know our business in particular, we're always looking to make those good investments because it's how we stay competitive and it's how we grow.
That's on the tax side. I want to get to the regulation side of things. Republicans, business people as well, often talk about the need to have less red tape so businesses can function more efficiently. Do you have an example of how that might have changed for your business since Governor Walker became governor?
Sure. And I hope it's okay if I kind of make a distinction between regulation and red tape.
Okay.
The businesses, I can't think of any business that, you know, wants to avoid regulations that are important to ensure that we have clean water, clean air, clean environment. You know, sometimes I think business gets a bad rap because, you know, we sometimes have issues with excessive regulations. Nobody wants those bad things, but what's important is that the reporting requirements and the ability to interact with government agencies is easier, and especially again for small businesses where we don't have people who are dedicated to government relations or specifically for the administrative aspects of complying with excessive regulations, having them be easy to understand, easy to comply with, and you know, not excessively burdensome is extremely important. Oftentimes, businesses spend an awful lot of time and money, and we call those non-value-added activities because it's really not changing how we do business. It's just complying with certain regulations. My personal experience has been very positive since Governor Walker has come into office. We have noticed a number of things. As all businesses, we have certain regulations that the DNR requires us to comply with. It has been much easier to work with the DNR. The folks are much more easily accessible. When we have questions, we get them answered in a much more timely fashion. And the overall reporting requirements seem to be more concise and kind of made easier for businesses to do the right thing. And so the cost of compliance is a lot lower. And I think that what, you know, the governor has referred to, the fact that they're seeing many fewer citations, I think that's because when you make it easy to comply, businesses in general want to do the right thing.
Well, and that's been a point of some criticism that the DNR is issuing fewer citations, saying that might give an incentive for more violations. If people aren't worried about being cited, it sounds like you don't worry about that?
Well, I don't agree with that because I don't think any business intentionally goes out to pollute or you know, do things that aren't consistent with good environmental policy. You know, there's a lot of positive motivation to do the right thing in business. A lot of our customers give us preferred status if we can demonstrate sustainability programs, good environmental impact, you know, things like that. So there's a lot of positive reinforcement for doing the right thing. And I would like to believe, I do believe, I guess, that ultimately the fewer citations is not a result of catching fewer bad guys, but really helping people do the right thing. And the state has really worked hard to make people available to businesses to provide them the information that they need to be able to comply.
We're talking to Mary Eisbister. She's president of GenMet, a metal fabricator based in Mequon, talking about how Governor Walker's policies so far, and we'll get to his new budget in a bit, are affecting businesses here in Wisconsin.
And we'd like to hear from you, particularly if you're a business executive in Wisconsin, at 800-642-1234. The governor has often said that Wisconsin is open for business. Has that been the case in your experience? And do you think his budget proposal has made the state more business friendly? Call 800-642-1234. 1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation about whether Governor Walker's slogan, Wisconsin is open for business, has held up during the past 4 years and if his current budget proposal serves that idea.
We're talking to Mary Eisbister. She's president of GenMet, a metal fabricator based in Mequon. She's the chair of Governor Walker's Council on Workforce Investment and was vice chair of the U.S. Manufacturing Council.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234, particularly if you're a business executive or business owner here in Wisconsin, or if you've sought out workforce training, maybe looking for a job in the past 4 years. How have Governor Walker's policies affected your business, and what do you think about his budget? Call us at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And let's, Mary, turn to the governor's new budget proposal. It's in the works. A lot of things could change. One of the biggest points of debate and biggest points that might change is this proposed $300 million cut to the UW system, along with flexibilities for the system. First, what role do you see the UW system itself playing in Wisconsin's business outlook in providing qualified workers for the jobs we have?
I think the UW system is absolutely essential to the workforce of the future for Wisconsin. A great many of the UW system graduates stay in Wisconsin and are you know, key and instrumental to building our businesses. I have found personally that the UW system is very responsive to local business needs and often will develop curriculum based on what, you know, their interaction with business tells them the future will bring in terms of new kinds of jobs, new kinds of careers and new technologies. I think we are very lucky in Wisconsin to have an exceptional university system. And, you know, I can't imagine what it would be like not to have it.
When it comes to workforce development, what are you looking for in a manufacturing worker?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Over the last 10 years, the workforce in manufacturing has evolved. 10 or more years ago, if you think about it as a triangle, the base of the triangle were the lesser skilled positions where people could come right out of high school and enter the workforce and be very successful in those kinds of jobs. There was sort of the middle of the triangle were some of the higher skilled positions, maybe your journeyman fabricators or your middle management. And then at the top, you know, the peak of the triangle, there was the you know, really, really long-term, high-skilled positions and your management. Today, the workforce looks a bit more like a diamond. At the bottom, that point, very few low-skilled jobs. So much has changed in manufacturing. It is truly a technology business today, and it's at the point where there aren't very many positions any longer that someone just coming right out of high school will really be qualified to do. What most manufacturing people need is at a minimum a 2-year, certainly a 1-year preferred a 2-year technical degree, and actually a large number of people are getting 4-year degrees or apprenticeships. That's kind of the middle of the diamond. And then again, at the top, you have, you know, your really specialty positions, very, very high skilled and high management positions. But the workforce it has to up its game. Manufacturing is a very advanced science these days, and is going to continue to be that way. And it's the demands are going to continue to increase for capability to enter the field.
Well, and Mary, when we look at that middle part, the big part of the diamond there, what do you think of Governor Walker's policies so far, or in the new budget proposal, when it comes to preparing the workforce to take the jobs in that middle part of the diamond, whether we're talking about education, job retraining, anything like that?
Yeah, there's actually a lot of really good things that the governor has put in place, both in this budget and his previous budget. Wisconsin Fast Forward is a grant program that represents the first time in Wisconsin history where state monies have been put aside for workforce training. Prior to that, all of the money that comes into the state is from the Department of Labor, the federal Department of Labor, for workforce training. But with the Wisconsin Fast Forward, actually state monies were put aside. That program has been highly successful, and I think one of the criteria that has made it so successful is that it is a public-private partnership that happens. Businesses have to be the sponsors, have to demonstrate that there is a job either currently existing or will exist for the folks that are being trained. And that's very, very important. The technical college system in Wisconsin has been, as well as the UW system, have both been excellent partners. And a lot of that training has focused on incumbent workers who need a new skill level because technology is evolving. It also has focused on bringing folks into the workforce, perhaps in a little bit more specialized or highly specialized skill that, again, either the technical college or the UW system has developed a unique curriculum for. That has been, number one, very successful in terms of getting folks into the workforce or keeping them in the workforce where otherwise that might not have been the case.
And Mary, I just want to jump in and bring a caller on before we run out of time. We've got Charlie on the line in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to ask a question for your guest. Is that now that we're a right-to-work state, wasn't there a role for the unions in maintaining and promoting worker education? And are we going to lose some of that?
Mary, we just have a few moments left. Quick thoughts on unions, their role, past and present, just a minute or so.
Sure, absolutely. So where I've seen the unions have their biggest positive impact is primarily in the construction trades. They've developed over the years exceptional apprentice programs, and they provide really exceptional worker training. I believe Right to Work won't change that because folks that see value in accessing and participating in that training will still want to be part of the unions.
Mary, thank you so much for spending the time with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Mary Eisbister. She's president of GenMet, a metal fabricator based in Mequon. We're talking about how Governor Walker's policies are affecting businesses here in the state. You can continue the conversation over at the Central Time Facebook page.